I'm so grateful for the way our ministers of music have led us so capably this morning. I should have known something was going to be different when I saw Owen up there wielding his bass guitar. You can like and follow him on Instagram. I do. And he is always uploading new music. It's just wonderful to be able to share and experience these disciples, emerging leaders of our church, showing up in all these wonderful ways. As we welcomed Don this morning back into the fellowship, I also spot another face that I think is a family that's worth noting. And Chaplain, it's good to see you this morning. Chaplain Dewey is a relatively new full-time chaplain with the Almance Orange Prison Ministry. It's a nonprofit supported through our contributions, the contributions of other churches, to make sure that there is a capable, competent evangelistic presence, helping to support the men of Orange County Correctional Center find their way in a place where it's just so easy to be lost and stay lost, and informing those communities of care and coming alongside each and every one of those men individually and together, and the staff. Chaplain Dewey is doing amazing work, and so I'm glad. It's a privilege to have you here, and the next time you're here, I'm going to put you in the pulpit and I'll sit down, but not today. You are a guest and a very special one, so make sure you linger and you meet this couple at the end of the day, as well as any other faces you may not recognize. Before I begin today, I do want to take a moment just to say something to Yates, to this congregation, because yesterday, as many of you know, and even today is evidence, I think there are some people who are just resting. Yesterday was a day that reveals what the church really is and what the church really can be. It was an extraordinary day. We came together and shared two memorial services together for Shirley Pickett and for Tony Pickett, her son, on the same day, for a family that's been part of this Yates community as long as there has been a Yates community. And what you may not have seen from the outside, because things moved with such grace and elegance, energy and care, was there was so much coordination and communication and the quiet exertion of dozens and dozens of people to make something that was very complex and complicated be very natural and welcoming. The flowers were where they needed to be. The food was ready, not quite on time, but that wasn't on us. That was on the restaurant. The parking was available. The music, wonderful. Everyone was greeted, cared for, seated, loved. And it was clear that the congregation had decided somewhere deep down that this is the sort of thing that we're here for. And I also want to name and be reminded of something that happened near the close of Tony's memorial time. At the end of that time, a room that's very full of grief, of a death that, because of the uncertainties and the doubts that always come with a cancer diagnosis and the suffering that it involves, we asked many questions that were held gently open before God. And though we could not claim a clear understanding of all the whys, we were very crystal clear on who was present to us and all of that. And very plainly said, if you don't know Jesus, this Jesus that we've been talking about even today, is a legitimate day to say yes. And if today was not that day, well, please know the name. And know that anytime you gather here, we gather around that name, because the good news that he has delivered, when it's proclaimed without embarrassment, without haste, in the middle of real life on our ordinary days and in our extraordinary losses, Jesus finds people exactly where they are. And that is where the relationship begins. And I say all of that and remind us of all of that because that is what our reading from this morning, from John's Gospel, chapter 4, is really about. During Lent, I've been saying, we're on a collision course. That's 3 weeks ago now. On Ash Wednesday, we stepped into the Hadron Super Collider, and we stood there in the wilderness with Jesus and set on a course with him 40 days, no bread, the voice that demanded he prove himself. Last week, we sat in the dark with Nicodemus, a very careful man who comes to Jesus at night because that conversation in the daylight was just going to cost him too much. And at each step of the way, as Jesus is making his way to Jerusalem, his presence and his words and actions in some way push back against the darkness that provides cover for us in this world, whether it's the secrecy that we named in the first week, whether it's the hesitation, as good intentioned, as well intentioned as it may be, was in the second. This week, we find another shadow, and the light of Christ comes blazing in again. It's a little easier to imagine this time because, to set the stage, it is noontime. There, high noon, the darkness isn't that thing that we manage in secret or in the dead of night, like Nicodemus. No, instead, this is a different sort of darkness, and it's one that we carry in the daytime and the nighttime, but it is powerful enough for us to organize our whole lives around it. And it is the shadow of our shame. Let's say that again. It is the shadow of our shame. Powerful enough, daytime, nighttime, anytime, to organize our whole life around it. And as we do, we find that shame can end up running the show of our lives for too long. And if we can't see it, and we don't experience the alternative, we may live and die in that shame. The woman that we're going to meet today doesn't even have a name in the story. It's not uncommon in the Bible. But in this case, she doesn't need one. It might be helpful. I think in some ways we already know this woman. If you open your Bibles, we'll be reading in John chapter 4, and I'm just going to be reading some excerpts because the story is told in very long form in John's Gospel. I'm going to be reading a little excerpts, and we'll kind of move through some digestible bites to hear what God has to say. So beginning in verse 5. It says this. So Jesus came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from his journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon when a Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" Pause. There are three details in three sentences I want us to hang on to now. And the first is that it's noon. John's really precise about this, that the women customarily would draw water in the morning or in the evening. Why? Use your common sense. If you have to carry gallons and gallons of water, and in this culture, it's a lot like Haiti, Mike, we'd see it as this incredible balancing act of carrying as much water on heads and shoulders as possible. You don't want to do it in the hottest part of the day. You do it when it's at least a bit cooler. But if she arrives at noon, it means she has chosen to come there. And she's chosen to come there when no one else will be there. She's built her whole day. She's budgeted her time and her energy around something. And we find that it's a wound. Because shame isn't just a feeling. Shame has the power to rewrite our calendars and the roadmaps that we follow in our lives. She knows exactly when the well is going to be empty, and she won't encounter anyone. That's when she chooses to come, even though she will suffer the heat of the noonday. Second, Jesus is tired. It's a wonderful picture of God in flesh, worn out and needing water. Vulnerable, asking for help. and he asks her for help. Jesus has come to give everything. But in this conversation, he opens by asking her for a drink. The last thing I want us to notice is that she gives every reason this should not be happening. You're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan. I'm a woman. We don't associate. Jesus knew the rules. She knew the rules. That she's learned to kind of announce and preempt these conversations because she knows deep down she is excluded. And sometimes when we know and experience that being left out or pushed out enough, it becomes the way we introduce ourselves to, in a sense, preempt the pain of being told to leave again. And so she names all the reasons it shouldn't happen. So Jesus doesn't have to say out loud, "Oh, you're a Samaritan? Bye. Get out of my presence until I'm done." No, again, that's shame. That can drive the way we present ourselves even in the world. It goes ahead in order to preserve us from the ongoing pain of more rejection. She names the reasons she should be excluded. But in the middle of these details, there's a light that's shining. Jesus does not honor any one of the reasons that she's named this shouldn't happen. He stays. He asks. He keeps talking. Every border, every wall, every division that she names, he pushes over, he crosses over, he moves through quite purposefully. So let's hear a little more of how John tells it. Verses 10 through 15. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that asks for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with and this well is deep. Where are you going to get this living water? Are you greater than our father, Jacob, who gave us this well, who drank from it himself, also his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I will give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water that I give them will become a spring of water, welling up to eternal life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I don't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." Of course, she's still thinking about the well. She's still thinking about the logistics. He's talking about special water, but she still needs a bucket and depth and a daily trip. And she's organized her whole life around just making sure the water gets there without compounding her exposure and her shame. But underneath the very practical question is the thing she isn't quite saying, but we can hear it. "I'm so tired of the way things are. Sir, tell me how I can get this water." There's a thirst beneath the thirst. And that's the real thirst. Beneath the parched tongue is a parched soul. She wants a life that she doesn't have to carry all alone. Jesus isn't just offering to refill what she has and send her on her merry way. He's offering her a transformed vision about where the water is even drawn and how it will satisfy and sustain and fill her. He's offering real change. "Sir," the woman said, verse 19, "I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and truth." And the woman said, "I know the Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us." And Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he. We're going to pause long enough simply to mention that Jacob's well, where they're meeting, is at the base of Mount Gerizim. This is the holy mountain of the Samaritans. And so this particular location was also the site of their destroyed temple. And so Jesus didn't just stumble into random geography. He's walked straight into the middle of the oldest dispute within the household of Judaism, and he sat right down. And there in that sort of national fracture, he engages the other side. So when this woman raises a question of which mountain, she's pointing not up, but down at the ground they're standing on. She's still trying to move the conversation from somewhere that feels risky and open and uncertain to something that is a little safer, closer to what she knows. Jesus lets her for just a little while. He answers the question that she's using to avoid the real question. And then when she mentions the Messiah, when she opens the door just enough, he walks straight through it. I, the one speaking to you, I am he. It's the clearest thing that Jesus says about himself, I think, in any of the four Gospels. And this is where he says it. He says it right here, alone, in a one-on-one conversation with this woman whose name we don't even know. The Greek behind that declaration of Jesus is ego eimi, I am. The same words that God speaks to Moses. There at the burning bush, it's the name that doesn't have a past tense, doesn't really have a future tense. It exists, in a sense, outside of time. That the God who met Israel in the wilderness is now sitting at a well in the midday heat, telling this woman exactly who she's talking to. And that's the light that shame cannot extinguish, overcome, or overshadow. It was shining before she arrived that day, and it shines when she leaves. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him, John says, verse 39, because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So the Samaritans came to him. They urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days, and because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." John tells us something about this journey from the well back to town for this woman. She had been ostracized, left out in many ways because her husbands continued to die, or she was left alone again. We don't know all the circumstances of why she was married so many times. We just simply know that in that culture, for a woman to be alone was for a woman to be abandoned, always having to yoke herself to some man out there just to remain safe, fed, and housed. But towns being towns, they're going to say what they're going to say. But when she goes back to town this time, she doesn't go back the way she came. And John gives us this little detail. He says she left her jar right there by the well. She left her jar. And I think that sentence is everything for us today. Because John's put into detail just before this passage that as she leaves and goes back to the city, she had come for one thing and she found another. And the old thing that she thought was so important, that the thing she thought was all important, the thing she believed defined her, was no longer relevant. That instead of returning as some sort of cleaned up version of what was, she comes back with a raw and honest story, unfinished and maybe difficult to say out loud. He told me everything I ever did. And even though she names the exposure of that honest relationship with the God who is, she offers it to all as an invitation. And that she has now organized her daily life once to conceal, but now to reveal Well, that's become everything in her testimony. What does that have to tell us? As I said, I think shame has the power to organize our lives. It has the power to organize our lives around our wounds. And when Jesus comes to us and walks into our lives, when he names what's true about us and he invites us to freedom, that's what this story is telling us about. It's not what I want you to carry into this room, bring it all. It is a little bit more about what you can leave here and not carry out. I think sometimes we misread this passage to see it as a way to talk about just how abominable this woman is, that it's some sort of cautionary tale. But that's not what's happening here. Jesus isn't treating her in this case as some sort of special study in moral failure. He's treating her with dignity as a person, beloved by God, created in the image of God. And he names what's true about her, but doesn't use it as a verdict or a gavel. Instead, he invites her to receive a refreshment and nourishment that no longer has to be built around that wound that has shaped her life. Our shame is not the same as our guilt, of course. Guilt tells us that we've done something wrong. It's important for us to have honest conversation about those things. Shame takes all of those little statements and internalizes them and says, I am something wrong. And over time, our shame is what's going to stop feeling so much like a wound that we carry around and simply be the truth we believe about ourselves. And when we look in the mirror, instead of saying, I did a bad thing, you say, I am a bad thing. I'm unworthy, unworthy of love, unworthy of inclusion, unworthy of promotion, unworthy of acceptance, unworthy, incapable, unlovable. And you think about that girl who has kind of memorized the path at her school and has to take this long way to fourth period because she knows which hallways are going to take her right past the table where they sit. And since the first week of school, she hadn't deviated from that long route. Nobody notices. But she's built her life that way. There's a man who was just released from his incarceration. He did a number of years. He's grateful, of course, to be out. He's paid his price. And he applies for jobs. And he knows those jobs are not going to call him back because he can't explain the gap in his work history except by telling the truth. He knows the questions that are coming, and he knows how to leave before the questions come. There's that family that drives past several clinics to the one where nobody really knows their name. They go there because the forms are also in Spanish. Nothing said inside those walls in the other clinics except that we're not making space for you. They've been doing this for years and have learned to scan where to locate themselves. The children, of course, don't need to ask why anymore. There's that deacon who served the church for decades, knows where everything is. Make sure everything is always ready, that there's something that needs doing when certain conversations start, moving in a certain direction. It's my job to be the person in the room to redirect. He's made sure of that, so that conversations don't grow more uncomfortable. I could go on and on, but the shame of exposure and the pain of our wounds is enough to reroute our lives. And we meet a woman today who had timed her life around a wound, and Jesus was at the place she thought she was escaping. That's the gospel. He's not waiting for her to get herself together, for the wound to heal on its own. He didn't ask her to send a cleaned up version over to the center of town. He moves toward her and he makes himself the one who needs something from her. And that's how God is changing our world. Because most of us have been named before too. Someone has known something true about us and they've used it against us. And when somebody gets really close to the real us, we move to the where the conversation feels a little safer. But Jesus names what is true about her, not to weaponize it, but to open her life in this conversation to something that really matters. Because God knows that being fully known won't kill you. And once we experience the kind of love that knows us fully and doesn't destroy us, then we know what it is to be held, loved, welcomed, forgiven, and changed. Think about that jar. She left it. She came for water. She walked away without it. What's your water jar? What's that thing you come back to again and again? Maybe it's the control. Maybe it's the approval. Maybe it's the drink. Maybe it's the image. Maybe it's the story that you keep telling yourself about who you are and what you deserve, but it never satisfies you because you can't imagine your day without it. That's where Jesus is. He's at that well you keep drawing from. Before you arrived, he knows. Everything you've ever done, every word you ever spoke, every version of yourself that you kept out of this place on Sundays, all of it. And he's still sitting at the well, still talking, still asking you for something so the conversation doesn't feel like an ambush. If shame is our scheduling system, then Jesus has taken everything we believed about our lives and is offering to rewrite it. As we move from this time, it is an opportunity for us to consider how it is that we continue to try and nourish ourselves. And as we examine the particularities of our lives, the routes we take, and the choices we make because we have listened to the world tell us where we are welcome, where we belong, look for Jesus in the places you think are your safety nets. Listen for him. How might he invite you to set down the pursuit of those things that do not last and instead follow him into a future that is uncertain? Accept that the constant companionship, the love of a God who will not let us go, will be with us every step of the way. If you're ready to leave that behind and accept the invitation to that relationship with Jesus, today may be that day. Just like we said yesterday, it may be tomorrow. But if today is that day, as we sing together, you make your way forward. We'll pray together. We can discuss what it is you need to set down and what it is you need to take up to serve the Jesus who meets you as you are and in love invites you to follow. Come and see. You'll be amazed.